Thank you for downloading part two of my interview with Peter Ash, founder of Under the Same Sun, which is a charity working with people with albinism globally, but particularly with those in Tanzania. So far, we've heard about Peter talking about his life and his work, and also we've been hearing about the killings in Tanzania and the gruesome things that are happening to people with albinism. So please listen on to part two. This podcast series has been made in celebration of International Albinism Awareness Day. Over the next 3 weeks, we're chatting with three more interesting people with albinism. But this is part two of my Peter Ash interview. So how many people this year have been attacked? Do you have figures? Or?
Oh, boy. I'd have to pull up the documents. But there's been, in Tanzania alone, that they're sadly constantly changing. But I think since December, if I'm not mistaken, so don't quote me on this, I'd have to get back to you on the exact numbers. I think there's been like six or seven.
And was there recently, I saw on Twitter, was it a two-year-old or a three-year-old?
There was in Tanzania a very
young child. I've got a three-year-old, and honestly, Peter, I cried. And this is how I don't know how you do it, because I think it's really easy for me, as someone with albinism, to sit there and read it, and when it gets too much, I turn away. I know it's a bad thing to do, and I should.
It's difficult. It's not for everybody, and I'll tell you, that's one of the challenges, frankly, we've had around public awareness. And even fundraising for our charity. We're a charity, right? We depend on donations to do what we do. And people are very supportive, and they feel badly about it, and they're genuine. But it's one of those charities that, for lack of a better term, it's not sexy. And there's a level of brutality, and it's a very disturbing thing to people. Appropriately so, it is disturbing. And so for some people, it's hard for them to stay engaged with the topic for any length of time. So for our staff who work for our charity here in Canada and in Tanzania, it's difficult for them. I have a catalog of pictures of all of these bodies that I have to look at. And our executive director and our staff in Tanzania have had to go and see them physically in person and go to morgues. And it's not for the faint of heart. But our philosophy is, and the reason I force myself to look at the pictures is because if my staff in Tanzania who work for me have to look at them, I should have to look at them. I can never ask them to do something I wouldn't be prepared to do myself. And I honor their story by telling it, by understanding it. Because if I turned a blind eye and say it's too grotesque to talk about, you know, let's not talk about it. Let's not look at it. I dishonor them. And their story doesn't matter anymore.
It sounds really flippant to say, but like, do you take it home with you? Can you switch off? Do some things really affect you?
Sorry to say, the longer I go, the better I get at turning it off. I like that and I don't like that. It's a necessary coping mechanism to be able to turn it off. I couldn't survive otherwise. But it's kind of like the analogy I've given people. I suspect it's like a doctor who works in the emergency room of a hospital. You know, how the first person that dies on his watch or the first car crash, where he looks at a mutilated body, probably tears him apart. And after he's seen 100, it's like somebody who works in a war zone. It bothers you. But you have to function. You have to find a way to some degree, detach in order to do your job. And I don't want to become detached. So I work hard at not becoming detached. When I'm in Tanzania on the ground with the people, I'm not detached. I get very attached, and when I'm with the kids and with the victims. And every trip I go, and I go 2-3 times a year, I make a point. Top of my agenda is visiting the recent attack victims in person. And I'll go to wherever I have to go to in the middle of nowhere to find them, because I want them to know that their story matters to me and that the world hasn't forgotten them and that they're not just a statistic. They're not just some albino in Tanzania that a Twitter feed talked about. This is somebody's brother, somebody's sister, somebody's mother. This is a human being, just like you and me talking here today, who did no fault of their own, simply because of how they looked, they were treated like worse than an animal.
And that's why I feel really guilty. That's exactly, you've just spoken about me, because I've got kids and because I've got albinism. I can look away. I see it on Twitter. I see it on Twitter. I see it on Facebook. I see it on BBC News websites, and I can just turn off. And I, do you know, I feel incredibly guilty. I feel so guilty because I struggle to, it's, you know, there, but for the grace of God, if
absolutely,
I could be that person.
You could, so
I
could
just,
I
happen to be born in the UK.
Exactly. And you know what, Christina, the thing is, you don't need to feel guilty because you're not turning away today. You're listening here today, and through your efforts and the work you're doing with your show, you're going to make sure the word does get out there. It's not fun or comfortable for any of us with albinism to hear this because it's very personal to us. And if we're a parent, it's very personal to us. You know, the Minyasi, the boy I talked to, he's exact same age as my son Brady, who's now 16. And that's what motivated me. Like, if somebody came in and chopped up my son in my house in the middle of the night simply because of how he looked, how would I feel? What's worse, though, is that most of these parents don't feel as disturbed as I would because they've been programmed to think their children are ghosts.
And
they
were
born and raised that way.
And some of the parents, they've been part of the killings, have they?
Oh, yes. In the majority of cases, relatives or family members or neighbors are often indirectly involved. Maybe they're not directly involved, but they're given money to turn the other way and turn the other cheek, so to speak, and turn a blind eye. So, unfortunately, in a lot of cases, we know the family are involved, the majority of cases, actually.
And is that through desperation because of poverty, or is that because they don't value their child?
It's a bit of both. Poverty certainly plays a role because they're offered a lot of money. But it's deeper than that because we've also found families who are equally poor, who I visited one father who sustained injuries, severe injuries, trying to defend his son. You know, and we found other families that have parents that have died trying to defend their children. So I would say poverty is a factor, but then when you meet equally poor families who do defend their children, then you realize that it's largely, the analogy I give people is this. If, let's say, you had a dog and your dog got a bad case of rabies and the dog was infected with rabies, it was just a wild, you know, sick dog, right? And your next door neighbor came to you and said, I'm going to give you £10 million for your dog with rabies. What would you do? You'd probably do the deal, right?
You'd do the deal. Of course you would.
And now, so put this on to a parent who's been born and raised from the time they could think that people with albinism are ghosts. They're curses. They really shouldn't be here. They're not human. And now you give birth to one of these things, to you, the way they think. And someone says, I'll give you a bunch of money to take this problem off your hands. And even the mother who might love the child because she gave birth to it has encountered social rejection from her extended family. So even if she developed a bit of a maternal bond with the child, maybe her parents or her relatives are saying, you know, this child makes you, you're unpopular in the community now. People are wondering, did you sleep with a white man? Because that's another myth. And so the mother has all this pressure and all this guilt, even if she loves her child. Maybe the, most of the cases, the father will leave, like the man will abandon them and blame the mother for giving birth to the child. So now she has been rejected by her husband, isolated by her community for this child. You know, so there's a lot of pressure on these parents, and most of them we meet are single mothers. And that's why one of the things we do is we have a group that's been started to help these mothers that have children with albinism. We teach them about albinism and about how to help their kids and what to do and that they're normal and all of that. But it's a complicated issue, you know. So that's why the solution broadly to this issue is public awareness. In Tanzania and across Africa is through, you know, we have two departments in our office. We have the education program for the kids that we talked about, and we have the advocacy and public awareness where we're constantly educating. We go into the rural communities and we do seminars and we say, this person's not a ghost. And we get our educated university graduate students who are on our staff with albinism to stand up in front of them and say, look, I have a university degree. My skin is perfect. I have albinism. I'm born in Tanzania. I'm not a ghost. Come and touch me. Come and touch my skin. I mean, I've stood up in churches and preached on Sunday mornings with thousands of people watching, and I'll go up to the pastor who's a black Tanzanian man, and I'll say, I've touched your pastor now, and you go talk to him in a month, and he won't be sick, I promise you, because one of the myths is that it's contagious.
Yeah.
You'll catch albinism.
Right.
And I'll just, we physically demonstrate in front of people that this is normal. This is a genetic medical thing. This is nothing more, right?
Hmm.
And public education works, though. I'll tell you, that's the good news, is that
most
of them – oh, it does. Once you tell them, They say, right. I didn't know. I had no idea.
Right,
and they change their attitude, like, right on the spot, mostly.
Right, okay.
And they say, I didn't realize they were normal people. My school teacher didn't teach me that. So it works, you know? And they start getting accepted in the community, and they start putting them in school. In some of these schools I was telling you about where we have our children in our scholarship program, what we've seen happening really encouraged us is that we would put 50 kids in a school, let's say, a school that had 400 kids, a private school. And over the last few years, we've been hearing now that parents from the neighborhood that had children with albinism that weren't attending school at all or were in maybe primary school and dropped out of public primary school are now bringing their kids with albinism and paying for them to attend private
school.
That's
awesome.
On their own. And the reason they give is we see how bright these kids with albinism are, and we're hearing about what your kids are doing and what this UTSS thing is all about. And we realize our kid could go to school and he could be smart. And so that gives me hope. You know, that parents are – that these kids and our work there is like a trailblazer to show people that, you know what, we're just like you. Which is why when we worked at the UN with them, you know, we realized that we needed to make this International Albinism Day thing happen.
Yeah, so how have you worked with the UN and how did the International Albinism Awareness Day come about?
Well, the UN work started back in 2009
mm-hmm.
when I met a lady – in the cafeteria of the UN in New York for 5 minutes. That's the only attention I could get. I flew to New York from Vancouver. It was a six-hour flight for 5 minutes in the cafeteria with a desk officer. And I showed her a bunch of newspaper articles about what was happening in Tanzania, and she said, thank you very much. And not much really happened for months and months and months. I kept emailing about a year and a half of badgering the UN. And then I found out human rights are dealt with in Geneva at the office of the UN, the Human Rights Council there. So then I badgered those people and got a meeting in Geneva and made a presentation to a bunch of UN staff, a PowerPoint, and they were interested, and it kind of faded again. And we just kept up sending the emails and the pressure over the years, and a new lady was assigned to the Africa desk that dealt with Tanzania, and she took a real interest. And one thing led to another, and there was an ambassador for Somalia named Yusuf Barry, who we got connected with, and he was really sensitive to the issue, and because you need a state sponsor, you need governments to get interested at the UN. Complicated system, and I won't get into all that, but suffice it to say we persisted, we got to know people, we kept flying to Geneva, we kept lobbying. We had IK Aero, who's our international advocacy officer. She is born and raised in Nigeria. She has albinism. She's a Canadian citizen. She's been living here since she was in her teen years. She has a degree in international human rights law. She works with us full time. She's been flying to Geneva with me and other staff. We've been lobbying. We got UN status as an official NGO recognized by the UN. Took years to get that. And we just made noise. We just kept showing up. These people with albinism kept parading around the UN, making noise, getting attention, flagging the issue. And eventually, one thing led to another. We got different resolutions passed. The UN, amongst other resolutions, did a preliminary study into the issue. They found out the same findings we had been saying was going on across Africa. And then through Yusuf, who worked with us, he pushed and lobbied to get governments behind this International Albinism Day. It got passed. And actually, the day after it got passed, not the day after it got passed, sorry, he passed that. And then we wanted another resolution. We wanted to get the UN. The UN can do what's called appoint an independent expert. So if there's a major grave human rights violation going on in the world, the UN can appoint an individual. It's like a commission of inquiry in a sense. So they can appoint an independent expert to study the issue and recommend things to states to deal with the issue. And we've been lobbying for this independent expert. They're very hard to get because of big budget constraints at the UN right now. And we wanted an independent expert on albinism. And they told us, you'll never get it, it'll take years, it's impossible, blah, blah, blah. We didn't give up. And Yusuf got the helped us get this International Albinism Day thing through all of our lobbying and his lobbying. And then we got the motion through on appointing an independent expert on albinism. And the day after, that independent expert got that decision was made that the UN would appoint such a person. Yusuf, who was a dear friend of ours, the ambassador for Somalia, was murdered in a terrorist attack in Somalia in his hotel. But interestingly enough, the resolution was passed in Geneva. We emailed him to let him know that it was passed. And he emailed us back that evening and said that he would fight for the cause of people with albinism forever. And he put forever in capitals. And then 24 hours later, he was murdered. So, but his work was not in vain. He was a key partner of ours, but we still persist at the UN. We have status as an NGO there, and IK, our staff member, will actually be going there for an International Albinism Day celebration on June 16th. I'll be in Tanzania celebrating Albinism Day. My brother Paul, who works with us, will be speaking at the World Congress of Dermatology in Vancouver on the 13th. So we're spreading our staff all over the world to proclaim and market this day. First time in human history that people with albinism exist in international law.
Oh, wow.
First time in the history of mankind that there are resolutions at the United Nations that you contain the word albinism.
Right, okay.
And the independent expert, they're interviewing for that person right now, and that person will be announced by the early July.
And will that be someone with albinism or not?
Yeah, well, that's up to them. We made a series of recommendations to them that it should, in our opinion, ideally be someone with albinism. So that's their call.
And do you know what's happening around the world for International Albinism Awareness Day?
Well, we're getting tidbits because we have our if you go to the Albinism Day website, I think it's called albinismday.com or World Albinism Day. I forget what it's called. Albinism Awareness Day or something like that. There's a link to it off of our website under the same sun. NOAA has it on there. A lot of the albinism, the UK group has a link to it.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to the Albinism Day website, which we put together as a way of promoting the day, all the groups around the world have had a chance to submit photographs and narratives of what they plan to do. And so if you go on there, you can see Australia is doing stuff, UK is doing stuff, lots of African groups are doing stuff.
Awesome.
NOAA's doing things, various European groups. So we're trying to get as many countries involved. We have a mailing list of about 90 albinism groups around the world that we have promoted it to. It looks like it's going to be quite a success.
It sounds like it is going to be a success. It's really getting out there.
I'm hoping that you know, you guys have a website too, right, for your show?
Yep. We do,
You could put a link on there for
absolutely.
And on your Facebook page. Link to the Albinism Day website and Facebook page. It also has a Facebook page.
Yeah, we're going to spread the word.
Because you know what I think is that if the more people get aware of it, sure, you know, in North America and Europe, we don't have the severity of these issues like the killings and all that. But you know as well as I do that there's still a need for public awareness.
Yeah, and I just think that's what I was saying. I just think it's about, you know, for parents who have got kids with albinism, it's just about having role models and seeing people out there and normalizing it as well,
exactly,
making it so it's not this weird thing.
Yeah, like the Hollywood films always have done in the past, you know, with all that sort of evil albino thing. So we're trying to normalize it. And actually, the UN has an albinism website now.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. I've seen it, actually. Yes. Yeah.
Actually, there's biographies and videos.
And the videos,
Of role models with albinism from around the world. And Sherry Parker's on there from Australia, and because she's the head of the World Albinism Alliance. And there's
several
others.
I've interviewed her as well. I spoke to her yesterday. So.
Yeah, and you've got Murray Brilliant on there as a geneticist, and you've got several others, some amazing, amazing people. There's a judge from Kenya, I believe, and then there's I'm on there, and there's several people. So it's a great website, and it's really gotten a lot of traction around the world because the UN has a big influence.
So lastly, what would you say? So for people with albinism out there, like me, who really want to, you know, who feel for this, you know, for everything that's going on out in Africa, you know, obviously I can't just get on a plane and go out there. Oh. You know, not everybody has money. What do you think people can do to make a difference?
I'll give you a few examples. Go to our Facebook page, underthesamesun.com, and then click on the Facebook or just do a search on Facebook. And you can share it with all your friends and family because, sure, maybe you can't make a donation, but maybe you have a friend or a relative that can donate a little bit of money. And it doesn't have to be a lot, $5. We have a campaign going on right now because of Albinism Day for hats and sunscreen. For Tanzania. So for $5, you can buy a hat and sunscreen for $10. Like for $5 or $10 or $15, you can make a big difference.
Hmm.
And so you can go on our Facebook page or our website And there's this special campaign set up in honor of Albinism Day. Can you, you know, can a person find their way to pay $5? Well, most people can.
Of course.
You know, just say no to your Starbucks craving, you know, and
yeah.
And or that burger or whatever you're going to blow $5 on, right? Like, it's not a big sacrifice for most of us in the Western world to find $5 or $10. And so that's a simple thing you can do to make a huge difference, because a hat or the sunscreen makes a difference to getting skin cancer or not.
Mm.
It could be a lifesaver. And then you get that out to all your friends and family who each give $5, right? Mm. And then also you can spread awareness to the media in your community through those things, letting them know about it. If you're, you know, if you're a praying person, you can certainly pray for us. We appreciate that. So, you know, those are just some simple things, that spreading the word to the people you know, making a donation if you can. Those are all things that anybody can do.
Thank you so much for talking to me. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. That's the end of Peter Ash's interview. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I did chatting with him. He's a really interesting guy. So we've got three more interesting people that I'm chatting with. Next week, there will be another podcast for download. But in the meantime, you can follow me on Facebook, find me on Twitter at Christina Venning, or go to my blog, thebluffingtonpost.co.uk.